Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. Welcome back to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Thursday, March the 28th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the opposition party's call for demonstrations in the West African state of Togo after the president announced measures to extend his term of office. Four people have been sentenced in the assassination of a Tunisian lawyer over a decade ago. West African women are gaining more recognition for their important role in agricultural production. And the security situation is worsening in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. In the second and third hours, we feature a panel discussion on the situation in Palestine, where genocide is continuing on the part of the Zionist regime, backed up by the Biden administration in the White House in the United States. We'll be listening to a live stream from Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the current situation in Palestine and in West Asia. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the legendary Miriam Makeba, also known as Mama Africa. Zinzili Miriam Makeba was born on March the 4th of 1932. She made her transition on November the 9th of 2008. She was called Mama Africa. She was a South African singer, songwriter, activist, civil rights and Pan-African activist and organizer. Associated with the genres which have been described as Afro-pop, jazz, and world music. She was an advocate against apartheid and colonialism in Africa and around the world. Born in Johannesburg to Swazi and Xhosa parents, Makeba was forced to find employment as a child after the death of her father. She had a brief and allegedly abusive first marriage at the age of 17. She gave birth to her only child in 1950, and survived breast cancer later on in life. Her vocal talent had been recognized when she was a child, and she began singing professionally in the 1950s with the Cuban Brothers, the Manhattan Brothers, and an all-woman group called the Skylarks, performing a mixture of jazz, traditional African melodies, and Western popular music. In 1959, Makeba had a brief role in the anti-apartheid film Come Back Africa, which brought her international attention and led to her performing in Venice, London, and New York City. In London, she met the African-American singer, Harry Belafonte, who became a mentor and colleague. She moved to New York City, where she became immediately popular and recorded her first solo album in 1960. Her attempt to return to South Africa that year for her mother's funeral was prevented by the racist apartheid government. And that's just a brief segment of the lifetimes and contributions of Miriam Makeba, Mama Africa. We'll listen to a 1962 release entitled The Many Voices of Miriam Makeba. Let's listen in. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast.
Mama, 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 then is enough. Makwala, mapongo, mapongwe ntiziyo. Then is enough. Makwala, mapongo, mapongwe ntiziyo. Then is enough.
Thank you. Mama, mania tão bonita, mania de dia feliz que chegou. Sono seu surgiu, em cada cor brilhou. Voltou só então a coração. Depois deste dia feliz, não sei se outro dia haverá. E nossa manhã tão bela final.
Welcome back. And that was The Many Voices of Miriam Makeba, a collection of tracks from 1962. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Thursday, March the 28th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Activists and opposition leaders in the West African state of Togo called on Wednesday for a protest to stop the country's president from signing off on a new constitution that would scrap future presidential elections and could extend his decades-long rule until 2031. The constitution, which was passed by the country's lawmakers earlier this week, but now awaits President Faure Gnassingbé's final approval, grants parliament the power to choose the president, doing away with direct elections. This makes it likely that Gnassingbé would be reelected when his mandate expires in 2025. Some legal experts say the constitution actually restricts the power of future presidents as it introduces a one-term limit and hands over greater power to a figure similar to a prime minister. But opposition's members fear the role officially, the president of the Council of Ministers, could become another avenue for Gnassingbé to extend his grip on power. The new constitution also increases presidential terms from 5 to 6 years. The almost 20 years that Gnassingbé has served in office after taking over from his father would not count towards that tally. In other news, in the North African state of Tunisia, four people were sentenced yesterday to death and two to life in prison for a murder that sparked widespread unrest in Tunisia and became emblematic of the country's early challenges transitioning from dictatorship to bourgeois democracy after the uprisings of 2010 and 2011. Chakri Belaid, the 48-year-old leader of the Popular Front Coalition, was a prominent critic of the Islamist party Ennahda that ascended to power after the 2011 uprisings toppled the country's longtime dictator, Ben Ali. His assassination was among a spat of violent episodes that provoked a protest in 2013 and became the emblematic of Tunisia's early struggles to reconcile its celebrated secular traditions with the revival of long-suppressed religious ultra-conservatives. A criminal court tasked with handling terrorism cases handed down 23 sentences for Belaid's murder. These sentences, in addition to the death penalties and life sentences, ranged in length from 2 to 120 years, a public prosecutor said outside of the court. Belaid's brother, Abdel Majid Belaid, called the sentences, quote, a positive step, end quote, and said that supporters were still awaiting the trial of those suspected of planning the assassination. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, Miriama Sonko's voice resounded through the circle of 40 women farmers sitting in the shade of a cashew tree. They scribbled notes, brows furrowed in concentration as her lecture was punctuated by the thud of falling fruit. This quiet village in Senegal is the headquarters of a 115,000-strong rural women's rights movement in West Africa. We are the solution. Sonko, its president, is training female farmers from cultures where women are often excluded from ownership of the land they work so closely. Across Senegal, women farmers make up 70% of the agricultural workforce and produce 80% of the crops, but have little access to land, education, and finance compared to men, the United Nations says. And finally, in this segment of our program, security in the Democratic Republic of Congo's mineral-rich eastern region has deteriorated since recent elections, with a rebel group allegedly linked to neighboring Rwanda making, quote, significant advances in expanding its territory, unquote, the United Nations Special Envoy for the conflict, RACT African Nations, said Wednesday. Bintou Keita told the UN Security Council this was created, quote, an even more disastrous humanitarian situation with internal displacement reaching unparalleled numbers, unquote. Last month, the United States told Rwanda and Congo that they, quote, must walk back from the brink of war, unquote, the sharpest warning yet of a looming conflict. U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood again condemned, quote, the aggressive military incursion, unquote, into eastern Congo by the M23 rebel group and the Rwandan Defense Forces and attacks, including on the United Nations peacekeepers. He called on the leaders of Rwanda and Congo, quote, to make the decision to pursue peace for the sake of their people, the region, and the world, unquote. With that, we'll conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March 28th, 2024, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Welcome back, and that was Minnie Riperton from her first album entitled Come to My Garden, released in 1970. That track was entitled A Rainy Day in Centerville. And the genocide against the Palestinian people is continuing in the Gaza Strip and throughout the entire occupied territories of Palestine. We're going to listen to a report released by Electronic Intifada, one of the most important primary sources on the situation in Palestine. Let's listen to this report from Electronic Intifada.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, March 27th. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 173 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including a full discussion with our friend Abdel Jawad Omar, a lecturer based in the West Bank, and a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian Armed Resistance with John Elmer. Dr. Yipeng Gui was supposed to join us, but unfortunately he had a travel delay at the last minute. We'll try to have him on next week. Here's some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. Israeli airstrikes hit areas across the Gaza Strip yesterday and today, including repeated attacks on Rafah in the southernmost area of Gaza. as well as Jabalia refugee camp in the north. Al Jazeera reported yesterday that the Israeli military bombed a house in Rafah, killing at least 15 people and injuring more. The building was housing displaced Palestinians, and among the dead are at least 4 children. Dozens more have been killed in a series of airstrikes on Rafah over the last 24 hours. For more than a week, Israeli forces have besieged and attacked Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, as well as the surrounding residential neighborhoods, in open battle with Palestinian resistance fighters who have continued to defend the area. Over the past few days, testimonies have emerged from people under siege at Al-Shifa Hospital who have described atrocities committed by the Israeli military, along with arbitrary arrests, torture, and the burning of people's homes in the area. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor reports that Israeli soldiers have been strip-searching civilians and using them as human shields. The human rights group stated on Sunday that, quote, testimonies reveal that Israeli forces used civilians, including patients and displaced individuals inside the Shifa medical complex, as human shields, exploiting them to protect their military operations within the hospital, form barriers behind their forces and military vehicles, or send them under threat to residential homes and buildings surrounding the medical complex to evacuate them before the Israeli army raids, arrests some of the residents, and subsequently destroys many of these buildings. One Palestinian identified as KF, who was sheltering in the Shifa medical complex, stated that Israeli forces ordered him and 3 other young men to enter several rooms inside the Shifa medical complex after cameras were attached to their heads. They were then forced to move by remote orders issued by the Israeli army towards specific locations for inspection. He added that he was forced by the Israeli army to move through orders in the general surgery building inside the Shifa medical complex for several continuous hours before being forcibly evacuated with his wife and daughter, while knowing nothing about the fate of the other young men used by the Israeli army as human shields in the same incident. Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported on Friday that Israeli forces have been systematically removing Palestinians from their homes around Al-Shifa and burning the buildings. A resident of the neighborhood told the human rights group that, quote, we saw death before our eyes. They stormed the residential building where my family resides, and suddenly we found 50 armed soldiers in the middle of the living room. They ordered the men to strip naked and the women to follow them. They took us to the first floor where they placed the men in a room next to us before taking them to Al-Shifa Hospital. As for us women, they ordered us to go down and head toward the southern areas of the strip. Another witness reported to Euromed that, quote, the Israeli army raided her house, separated women from men, and instructed women to go alone with their children to the southern areas of the strip before setting the house on fire and burning it completely. The Director General of the World Health Organization stated over the weekend that the conditions at Al-Shifa are, quote, utterly inhumane. A doctor at Al-Shifa relayed to him the following information. 50 health workers, most of them junior or volunteers, and 143 patients have all been kept in one building since the second day of the raid, with extremely limited food, water, and only one non-functional toilet. Patients are in critical condition, many lying on the floor. 3 patients are in need of intensive care. 2 patients are on life support. 2 patients on life support died due to a lack of electricity. Patients have no companions or caretakers, no basic medical supplies, no dressing, no medicines available, and health workers have requested urgent patient referrals. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza stated on Tuesday that Israel has, quote, tightened its siege of health personnel, patients, and wounded in the Shifa medical complex, detaining them inside the human resources development building in the complex that is not prepared for healthcare, and preventing them from leaving it. Reports have emerged that the Israeli army is now using Al-Shifa Hospital as a military base. Along with the attacks on Al-Shifa, Israeli forces have resumed their attacks on the Nasser medical complex in Khan Yunis over the last several days, arresting and detaining medical staff and displaced persons. Also in Khan Yunis, the Palestine Red Crescent Society announced on Tuesday that its headquarters, the Al-Amal Hospital, has been entirely taken out of service following an Israeli siege that lasted more than 40 days. The Red Crescent stated that Israeli occupation forces forced hospital staff and wounded patients to evacuate the hospital and then closed its entrances with dirt mounds. In a statement, the Palestine Red Crescent Society said it, quote, expresses its disappointment that Al-Amal Hospital was taken out of service after the international community failed to provide the necessary protection for its staff, patients, and displaced persons. The hospital was besieged for more than 40 days and shelled several times before the occupation forces resumed its siege again and forced everyone in it to leave, leaving the hospital destroyed. The same fate befell the Red Crescent's Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City, which was taken out of service several months ago. The Palestine Red Crescent added, quote, this direct targeting of the Red Crescent's Al-Amal Hospital and its crews is added to the Israeli occupation's record of continuous violations against medical personnel in general and against Red Crescent medical personnel in particular since the start of the aggression against the Strip on October 7th of last year. The number of Palestine Red Crescent martyrs that were targeted by the occupation forces while performing their humanitarian duties has reached 15, while the occupation continues to unlawfully arrest 13 Red Crescent crews whose whereabouts and fates remain unknown. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs stated on Monday that Red Crescent staff and wounded patients were transferred to Rafah after being trapped in ambulances outside Al-Amal Hospital for about 20 hours. The Israeli military had forced them to evacuate the hospital on Sunday, and when two people exited the ambulances to clear the rubble on the road to the military checkpoint, they were fired on by the Israeli army. Upon returning to Al-Amal Hospital, they found the door closed and were trapped inside the ambulances. The Israeli military said it had killed 20 armed Palestinians in or around Al-Amal Hospital. Israeli forces are continuing to massacre Palestinians awaiting aid deliveries, especially in northern Gaza, as part of Israel's engineered starvation policy. On Tuesday, Palestinians drowned after an airdrop of humanitarian aid landed in the frigid waters off the Gaza coast in the north, and people swam out to retrieve the parcels. The U.S. White House said it will continue supplying humanitarian relief from the air into the Gaza Strip, despite Palestinians dying by drowning, stampedes, and falling aid boxes while trying to reach the aid, Al Jazeera reported. A spokesperson for the National Security Council told the network that, quote, airdrops are one of the many ways that we are helping to provide desperately needed aid to Palestinians in Gaza, and we will continue to do so, as thousands of aid trucks remain stuck at the border crossings. On Tuesday, Palestinians awaiting aid at the Kuwaiti roundabout in Gaza City documented the scene where Israeli snipers shot at people awaiting aid. This comes just days after the Israeli military announced it was no longer approving any aid convoys to the northern Gaza Strip that are administered by UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. The UN reports that between March 16th and 22nd, 9 out of 17 humanitarian aid missions to northern Gaza were facilitated by the Israeli authorities, 5 were denied, and 3 were postponed or withdrawn. During the same period, 33 out of 42 humanitarian aid missions to southern areas that require coordination were facilitated by the Israeli authorities, 4 were denied, and 5 were postponed or withdrawn. Philippe Lazzarini, UNRWA's Commissioner General, admonished the Israeli government, saying it was, quote, outrageous and makes it intentional to obstruct life-saving assistance during a man-made famine. He called on the restrictions to be lifted, adding that, quote, UNRWA is the largest organization within the highest reach to displaced communities in Gaza. By preventing UNRWA to fulfill its mandate in Gaza, the clock will tick faster towards famine and many more will die of hunger, dehydration, and lack of shelter. This cannot happen. It would only stain our collective humanity, Lazzarini said. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine, presented a report to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, stating that there are, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Albanese's 25-page report titled Anatomy of a Genocide documents in searing detail how Israel has committed acts of genocide over the last 6 months of attacks on Gaza. Albanese said, quote, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent, causing seriously bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. Furthermore, Albanese said that, quote, the genocide in Gaza is the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of the native Palestinians. Albanese's recommendations include that UN member states immediately implement an arms embargo on Israel, as it appears to have failed to comply with the binding measures ordered by the International Court of Justice in January, as well as other economic and political measures necessary to ensure an immediate and lasting ceasefire and to restore respect for international law, including sanctions, and to support South Africa's intervention at the International Court of Justice.
Months of unrelenting Israeli assault on occupied Gaza, it is my solemn duty to report on the worst of what humanity is capable of, and to present my finding, the anatomy of a genocide. One of my key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted rules of international humanitarian law, distinction, proportionality, and precaution in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people, by deliberately stretching the definitions of human shield, evacuation orders, warnings, safe zones, collateral damage, and medical protection, Israel has used their protective function as humanitarian camouflage, with the effect of concealing patterns of conduct from which the only inference can reasonably be drawn is a state policy of genocidal violence against the Palestinians. In light of this, I find that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group.
That was Francesca Albanese in Geneva yesterday. Albanese's presentation at the UN Human Rights Council came a day after the UN Security Council voted to adopt a Gaza ceasefire demand. Maureen Claire Murphy reported that, quote, nearly all 15 member states voted in favor of the resolution, with the exception of the U.S., which abstained but did not veto the text as it quashed three previous draft resolutions calling for a ceasefire. Maureen adds that, quote, the adopted resolution demands an immediate ceasefire during Ramadan, which is halfway over, leading to a lasting, sustainable ceasefire. Russia sought to change the resolution's language of a lasting ceasefire to a permanent ceasefire, but did not gain enough support. The adopted resolution also calls for the, quote, immediate and unconditional release of all hostages and demands that, quote, parties comply with their obligations under international law in relation to all persons they detain. The brief text also demands the lifting of all barriers to the provision of humanitarian assistance at scale in line with international humanitarian law and previous resolutions adopted by the Security Council. The practical implications of the Security Council resolution for Palestinians enduring what the UN's principal judicial organ has ruled to be a plausible genocide remain to be seen, given that the U.S. continues to arm and greenlight Israel's military operations, Maureen writes. For more on the UN Security Council's resolution, read Maureen Claire Murphy's latest report, UN Security Council Adopts Demand for Ramadan Ceasefire in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. Hamas stated on Monday that it welcomed the UN Security Council's ceasefire call, adding that, quote, we stress the necessity of reaching a permanent ceasefire that leads to the withdrawal of all Zionist forces from the Gaza Strip and the return of the displaced to the homes from which they left. We also affirm our readiness to engage in an immediate prisoner exchange process that leads to the release of prisoners on both sides. Hamas calls on the Security Council to pressure the occupation to adhere to the ceasefire and stop the war of genocide and ethnic cleansing against our people, end quote. And finally, news from the occupied West Bank. Tamara Nassar reports that, quote, Israel approved the seizure of one of the largest chunks of land since the Oslo Accords were signed by Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization in the mid-1990s. Bezalel Smotrich, the ultra-far-right Israeli finance minister, declared nearly 2,000 acres of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank as so-called state lands. Smotrich said, quote, we are promoting settlement through hard work and in a strategic manner all over the country. The announcement was made on the eve of the arrival of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Israel. Declaring Palestinian land as state land is a legal maneuver aimed at confiscating land belonging to Palestinians by interpreting an Ottoman law that was utilized in a completely different context nearly two centuries ago. Meanwhile, a Palestinian gunman opened fire on a bus near the Israeli settlement of Dolev in the occupied West Bank on Thursday. Mujahid Barakat Mansour was chased by Israeli troops for hours before being killed by a missile fired by an Apache helicopter. One Israeli soldier was killed and seven others were wounded during the operation. The settlement of Dolev was established in 1983 on lands from the nearby Palestinian villages of Jania, Ain Kinya, and Deir Ibzi. Tamara writes that, quote, Israel has escalated its lethal attacks across the occupied West Bank under the guise of targeting emerging armed resistance. Israeli troops invaded the Nur Shams refugee camp on March 20th and killed four Palestinians, including two children. Dozens of Israeli armored vehicles, including bulldozers, raided the camp east of Tulkarm city in the northern occupied West Bank and began bulldozing roads and underground infrastructure in the camp. The Israeli army does this under the pretext of an increase in makeshift explosives planted beneath roads to target invading Israeli armored vehicles. Also on March 20th, an Israeli drone-fired missile struck a vehicle in the Jenin refugee camp, killing four Palestinians associated with the Jenin Brigades, Tamara reports. During the funeral procession of the four men, Palestinians demanded that the Palestinian Authority release detainees affiliated with the Jenin Brigade to allow them to bid farewell to their comrades before burial. The PA violently suppressed the protest by firing tear gas canisters at funeral attendees, resulting in injuries to four people, one of whom sustained a head injury. For much more, please read Tamara Nassar's latest report, Israel Accelerates Land Theft in the West Bank, on electronicintifada.net. And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our fantastic new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up, we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza and a conversation with Abdeljawad Omar in the occupied West Bank. But first, Ali Abunima, we wanted to have a brief discussion on the latest updates in the New York Times October 7th mass rapes fraud. Ali, what can you tell us? What's new in this developing story? Oh, you're muted, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you for that very sobering news update. It's hard to believe that we're coming up to 6 months of this, and each and every day there are new horrors. I just saw this morning, first thing, Hind Khodari, the journalist, we've had her on the live stream before, talking about how her uncle and cousin were murdered by Israel. Yeah. I guess it would have been yesterday. And I just want to mention that to remind everyone and I think people know this, that we can't get used to this. We can't normalize it. And it's very, very tough every day for everyone in Gaza. We've said before, Nora, every time we have this discussion, we say we hope it's the last time, but we know that we have to come back to this. I mean, there's good news in the sense that this narrative just keeps falling apart, and there's bad news that they keep trying to revive it. So I guess let's start with the good part of that, which is the revelations, more revelations that let's start with, if you don't mind, the story about Kochav Elkayam Levy. Nora, you'll remember her. We spoke about her in our live stream on December. And Tamara, maybe you can just put up item one on the list I sent you, which shows us just a reminder of when we spoke about Kochav back in December. And let's look at item two, Tamara. And this is a new article I've done detailing in more detail some of what we're going to talk about today. But if we just scroll down, you can see that right there, this was that screenshot there. I don't know if we can zoom in on it, but you can see that's a Haaretz story from the end of November. And that's a picture of Elkayam Levy, Kochav Elkayam Levy, who was everywhere in the media at that time, claiming to have, claiming to be the head of something called the Civil Commission to investigate these claims of mass rape. And if we go to item 2B, Tamara, you can see that just actually a few days after that Haaretz article, Kochav Elkayam Levy was actually welcomed at the White House by the Joe Biden administration. And you can see there in the official White House statement on that meeting from December 7th, 2023, they identify her as the chair of Israel's Civil Commission on October 7 crimes by Hamas against women and children. But what has emerged in the last few days is really quite incredible. It turns out that Elkayam Levy won the Israel Prize. This is Israel's highest civilian cultural honor. It's awarded by a committee of the great and the good in Israel, and it's administered by Israel's education ministry. And there's been a lot of infighting about this in Israel, and we're the beneficiaries of this because what has emerged is, as so often when Israelis fight amongst themselves, is they tell truths that we're not supposed to hear. And so it turns out, and this was reported, we can go back to the story, to item two, Tamara. It turns out that now in Israel, Kochav Elkayam Levy and her civil commission are being exposed as a complete fraud. And it's really incredible. According to Yediot Ahronot, this is one of Israel's biggest newspapers. They did a report just a couple of days ago, and they actually find that her civil commission doesn't exist. It's a one-woman show. There is no civil commission. And moreover, the report which she won the Israel Prize for, this is supposedly a report detailing the crimes, the rapes, the sexual violence on October 7th, that report doesn't exist either. She hasn't written any such report. And she seems to be something of a financial grifter. And so it's according to Ynet, what she's been doing is going around asking for money. She has this organization she calls the Devorah Institute, and they've been sending around a budget for their work on this so-called civil commission for 2024, a budget of $8 million, of which $1.5 million is earmarked for management and administration. And she's been collecting a lot of donations. It's even been reported that she got a donation from Rahm Emanuel, the U.S. ambassador to Japan and previously the chief of staff to President Barack Obama. And on her website, on the Devorah Institute, it lists the government of Canada as one of her partners. I wasn't able to confirm in the time I had that she's actually received funding from the Canadian government, but that's something that particularly our viewers and friends in Canada should be inquiring into. And I don't know, Nora, do you want me to go into some of the sort of juicier revelations that have come out about this fraud?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really important. I mean, there's just the title of her grifty organization, the Civil Commission, sounds like a normal government assembled sort of entity. But,
And it seems to be that she was presenting it as some kind of official Israeli body.
Right.
And in fact, Ynet, the Yediot Ahronot, quotes an Israeli government source saying that the following, this is in Ynet, at first she was very active and it was very nice, and then she started calling herself the Civil Commission. People got confused. Members of the U.S. Congress turned to people who work with Israel and asked, what was this about? Did Israel create a commission? It's a confusing name. And of course, she didn't create a commission, but she did apparently even fool the White House. Whether they wanted to be fooled or not is another question. But they introduced her as if, or they spoke about her in that statement, as if she were an Israeli official. But here's what this government, Israeli government source says to Ynet, and to the question of, is there such a thing at all? Is there such a body? The answer is no. She is the body. She is the Civil Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And this same government source says that people are sort of treating her as kind of a pariah now in Israel, because this is, again, the government source quoted in Ynet, people disconnected from her because her investigation is not accurate. And they say that she disseminated, for example, a story about Palestinian fighters slicing the belly of a pregnant woman, a story proven to be untrue, and spread it in the international media, end quote. That's actually what the Israeli government source told Ynet. And to be clear, the Israeli government source here is not saying, oh, this is bad, spreading these lies is bad because it's an injustice to Palestinians. They're saying spreading the lies is bad because it damages our hasbara, our public relations efforts, and we're already having enough trouble in itself. But let's take a look at this, because this is actually a big story in Israel. Ynet reported on it, and Channel 13, which is one of the main TV channels in Israel, also did a report on all this fraud coming out. And let's take a look at that report, and what we'll do is we'll watch it. It's got, we have translated it from Hebrew and put English subtitles. We'll watch it, and then I will summarize some of the points in it afterwards for those who are listening. So you're just going to hear the Hebrew now and see the English subtitles for those who are watching.
רביב דרוקר, ערב חדש, מבוכה חדשה סביב סגת פרס ישראל, והפעם?
כן, דוקטור כוכב אלקיים לוי עשתה עבודה, היא חתנית קלת פרס ישראל, היא עשתה עבודה ברוכה וחשובה בלי שמץ של ציניות בהעלאת המודעות הבינלאומית לזוועות המין שבוצעו על ידי החמאס. אבל התהייה העולה, קודם כל, היו מספר נשים מאוד בולטות שעשו פעילות, וזה לא ברור למה לקחו דווקא אותה ולא נתנו לכולן. רות אלפרין קדרי,
פרופסור יפעת ביטון,
שאשא ביטון, פרופסור ביטון,
לא שאשא ביטון, כל הזמן טועים.
נכון, סליחה.
כן.
ועוד כמה וכמה. הנימוק שנותנת הוועדה המכובדת בראשות יורם גאון, הוא שהיא חיברה את דוח הזוועות, אלא שפה אנחנו מגלים שאין דוח זוועות, פשוט אין דוח כזה, לא נכתב דוח כזה, לא על ידה ולא על ידי אף אחד אחר חוץ מגופים בינלאומיים דווקא. יש איזה מכתב שהיא שלחה שבועיים אחרי האסון, אחרי הטבח של 7 באוקטובר, שהוא ריכוז כותרות מהעיתונים, מכתב של כמה עמודים בודדים, ודוח כזה, אנחנו שואלים אותה הערב על הדברים האלה, וגם על הקשר המשפחתי שלה, היא אחייניתו של יעקב ברדוגו, הנה הדברים שהיא עונה.
בטח שיש דוח כזה. הדוח הראשון שיצא כבר ב-20 באוקטובר, דוח שסקר את הפשעים שראינו, את המידע הכי מיימן שיכולנו לתת ברגע הראשון לגופי האום. אין לי עוד מה לומר בנושא חוץ מזה שאני גאה במשפחה שלי.
יש דוח כזה.
כן, אז כמובן אפשר להראות את הדוח עוד מעט על המסך המצא. זה מכתב של 4 עמודים, עמוד אחד זה חתימות, עמוד אחד זה אמירות כלליות, ושני עמודים זה כותרות מהעיתונים פשוט. אף אחד לא ידע עוד כלום ב-20 לאוקטובר. זה לא דוח במובן של זה וזה עשו בבחורה האיש שחס וחלילה נרצחה, זה הפשע, זה הראיות. אין דוח כזה. היא טוענת שהם עמלים על דוח כזה, הוא נשמח מאוד שהוא יצא יום אחד, אבל אם זה נימוק הוועדה, למה היא כן ואחרות לא, אז הנימוק הזה פשוט לא תקף. ולא מחזיק מים.
מה אומרים במשרד החינוך?
במשרד החינוך אומרים, דומה לה, כנראה שזהה לתגובה שלה, שהיה דוח קודם, והיא עומדת על דוח חדש, ומדברים על כך שהיא הפעילה נציבות אזרחית להעלאת המודעות. צריך לומר, גם הנציבות האזרחית זה שם מאוד מפוצץ, הנציבות זאתי, והיא זאת הנציבות, אין איזה גוף גדול שנציבות שפועלת בכל העולם, זאתי פעולתה ברוכה, זה שרק היא מקבלת.
So what you can see there, that's the report that appeared on Channel 13, and that's the reporter Aviva Drucker talking to the anchor there. And the context for this is that there's sort of professional jealousy. Why did Kochav Elkayam Levy get the Israel Prize when supposedly there are other women who've worked on exposing the, as we now know, non-existent October 7th mass rapes? But what he says, some of the key quotes, he says, they mention her starting a civil commission to raise awareness. It bears mentioning that the name civil commission is very bombastic. The commission is her and she is the commission. And he says that she was also the head of the Israel Prize Committee, awarded, said Elkayam Levy received the award because she authored something called the Horrors Report, a report that supposedly would detail the sexual violence on October 7th. But then Drucker says, we realize that there is no Horrors Report. There is simply so no such report. It hasn't been written, not by her, not by anyone. She claims that she did write a report at the beginning in October, and that's when she started to gain this international prominence. But what Raviv Drucker says is that that's just misleading. He says it's a 4-page document, 1 page is signatures, 1 page is general statements, and 2 pages are just newspaper headlines. It's not a report in the sense that he and him did to that girl who, God forbid, was murdered. This is the crime. This is the evidence. There is no such report. So the whole thing appears to be a scam that was promoted by none other than the Joe Biden White House by receiving this woman and giving her the chance to present herself as if she were heading some official investigation. And as noted there, Raviv Drucker points out that there appears to be some kind of nepotistic element to this, because Elkayam Levy is the niece of a man called Yaakov Berdugo, an advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu and a right-wing commentator on Israeli army radio. But that's not her only connection to the Netanyahu administration. As I mentioned, her organization, the Devorah Institute, which an Israeli government source described to Ynet as a one-person outfit asking for $1 million donations, it it has on its advisory board the director, a former director of the Israeli Prime Minister's office, and three former officials from the Israeli National Security Council. So, and then just one other thing to say about this, the Ynet story points out how she disseminated false propaganda, you know, these atrocity claims. But that was known early on and was reported by other independent journalists, including Max Blumenthal. So let's just take a look at Tamara at clip. This is item three, the video, which shows her actually lying at an event in Harvard. I think this was back in November.
Another image shows the body of a young woman stripped from the waist down, her underwear torn, hung on one leg, and she was photographed on the site at the Nova Music Festival.
All right, so that clip there where she's claiming to describe a photo of a woman victim at the Nova rave or festival that was attacked on October 7th was in fact a photo of a Kurdish female fighter from 2022 and not in Israel, in another country. So this fraud was exposed from early on, but it has now been exposed in the mainstream in Israel. But you heard it here first.
And of course, none of that interview from Channel 13 that we showed has been transcribed in English except for the Electronic Intifada. I mean, wouldn't the New York Times want to look into that?
You would think, because remember, this person was everywhere in the media and
yeah.
She was given credit, and it's why she won the Israel Prize. So she fooled people inside Israel and outside Israel. And let's see, you know, now that she's been exposed within Israel, if any of this makes it out into the mainstream media in the West, where so many people continue to insist that these lies upon lies about October 7th should be taken seriously.
Yeah. And just one more point on the Devorah Institute, that she heads, it's her operation. That they are taking tax-deductible donations from, like if you're in the U.S., you can make a tax-deductible donation to this fraudulent, grifty organization through, I believe it was the Jewish Communal Fund.
That's right, the Jewish Communal Fund of New York.
Yeah.
And also, and she's certainly, as we said, according to the Israeli press, collected a huge amount of money. And that's not uncommon, because what we've seen also is other organizations involved in the October 7 lies about, you know, atrocities, burned children and beheaded babies and so on, like Zaka, have also been going around. And our colleague Asa Winstanley actually has a new story up on EI about Zaka and noting how they went around after October 7th and have been collecting huge donations on the back of the lies that they're telling, genocidal lies against Palestinians.
Related, there have been new revelations further debunking the New York Times' infamous Screams Without Words story from December. You just published something on that yesterday. What's new there?
Yeah, I mean, this is really incredible, because people will recall the Screams Without Words story. We've talked about it extensively at the end of December by Jeffrey Gettleman, Anat Schwartz, and Adam Sella. That has fallen apart. Absolutely nothing is left of it in terms of its key claims. And yet the New York Times is still has it up. And there was this one story in it, one particularly horrifying story, where it's claimed that an Israeli army medic on October 7th went into a house in Kibbutz Be'eri. This is one of those colonial settlements we've talked about repeatedly, and saw the bodies of two teenage girls in a room. And I quote from the New York Times story of December 28th, and again, I warn viewers that this description from the New York Times is graphic. This is what they reported in December about the two teenage girls allegedly found by this Israeli army paramedic. Quote, one was lying on her side, boxer shorts ripped, bruises by her groin. The other was sprawled on the floor face down, pajama pants pulled to her knees, bottom exposed, semen smeared on her back. The New York Times also says that the paramedic did not document the scene and that they only spoke to this Israeli military member with permission of the Israeli army and on condition that he not be identified. So again, the sourcing was already very vague. And as we pointed out when we addressed this story back in January, it had already been debunked by Mondo Weiss. Then in early March, it was debunked again by The Intercept, which actually identified the two teenage girls, and they did an extensive story showing that they were not, in fact, sexually assaulted. And then comes the New York Times, which just yesterday published, March 25th, so this would have been Monday, published a story conceding that this claim in their original report is false. And they say, quote, new video has surfaced that undercuts the account of an Israeli military paramedic who said two teenage girls killed in the Hamas-led terrorist attack on October 7th were sexually assaulted. And they cite footage taken by an Israeli soldier, quote, which was viewed by leading community members in February and by the Times this month, and it shows the bodies of three female victims fully clothed and with no apparent signs of sexual violence at a home where many residents had believed the assaults occurred. The kibbutz Be'eri residents who viewed the footage said that in no other home in Be'eri were two teenage girls killed, and they concluded from the video that the girls had not been sexually assaulted. And I'll also add that the UN report by Pramila Patton that we talked about and wrote about at the Electronic Intifada that we criticized for really regurgitating mostly Israeli government propaganda, even that report says that they could not substantiate a single claim of sexual violence in Kibbutz Be'eri, and that several of the most prominently reported claims, and I believe that includes this one, were unfounded, in the words of the UN report. And there's another wrinkle here which is incredible, which is when we went back and looked, these two sisters, and they were identified as N, and they were identified by The Intercept as Y and N Sharabi, aged 13 and 16. One of them was actually missing for more than a week after October 7th and was not identified. Her body was not identified until late October. So that makes it even more bizarre that an Israeli paramedic could have claimed to see all this. And that's to say, you know, it's hard to sort out now what actually did and did not happen. But all of these contradictory details that were known at the time the New York Times published its original story should have made them stop and look for corroboration before publishing this story, but they did not do that.
No. And I mean, now that their original story, the New York Times' original story, has now been fully debunked little piece by piece. There's really nothing left of that story. But is there any indication that it's planning to, you know, correct Screams Without Words or do what it should be doing and retract and apologize?
So far, no. The only thing the New York Times has done is they inserted sort of a misleading update into the original story, as if this story hadn't already been debunked at the time it was published in December. So they're trying to give the impression that this is new information, when in fact it was already known that this story was false or unlikely or dubious at the time they published their story, but they didn't want to know it then. So they don't call it a correction, they call it an update. And we wrote to the New York Times and asked them if they still stand by the original Screams Without Words article, if they're planning to retract it, if they've carried out an internal investigation, and they haven't replied to us. See there, there's the update on the screen. They say newly released video viewed by the Times. So they're trying to give the impression that the story was solid prior to this newly released video, when in fact the story had already been debunked at the time they originally published it in December.
Incredible. I mean, you said this at the beginning, but like, will this issue ever end? What updates can we possibly update to this, like, already completely, you know, dissolved story?
Well, you know, it's curious. So this, the New York Times publishes a story on March 25th, debunking its own reporting, which it's still confusingly standing by at the same time. And then the next day, they publish a new sensational story. This one here we see on the screen with the headline, Israeli hostage says she was sexually assaulted and tortured in Gaza. And this is a 4,000-word story about an Israeli woman called Amit Susana, who was held in Gaza for several weeks, and she was released in November. And now she's claiming, she's come out and said that while she was held in Gaza, one of her guards, a man she identifies as Muhammad, forced her to carry out a sexual act, which she does not describe in detail. And they build a 4,000-word story about this. There's no way to know, you know, she may be lying, she may be telling the truth. We can't evaluate that. What we can say is this is very curious that this is coming out now, 4 or 5 months after she was released. If we look at item six, she gave a press conference in January. And again, this was now, I would say, she was released at the end of November. So this is more than a month after she was released. She gave a press conference in January, which is on video, we've watched the video, in which she makes no mention whatsoever of this assault. Now, you could say, okay, she didn't want to talk about it, very well. But what's, again, been pointed out, if we look at tweet seven, if I may call them, friend of the show, Zay Squirrel, the anonymous investigator who has revealed so many important details about this, that when this story was launched yesterday by the New York Times, it was part of a coordinated push by Israeli government accounts that were all suddenly pushing it, as if it somehow corroborates the lies about mass rapes on October 7th. There's important things to point out here, which is that the 4,000-word New York Times story about Amit Susana doesn't use the word rape. It doesn't claim that this incident, if it happened, was part of any systematic pattern. It describes an isolated incident, and it actually quotes Bassem Naim, a senior official of Hamas, saying that we would want to investigate this because Hamas has been very clear that they do not tolerate this kind of assault on captives. But it's really, again, the context of this is so important because the New York Times is devoting 4,000 words to this one alleged incident when, if we take a look, Tamara, I don't know if we can bring up tweet number eight, which is from Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur from the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, and we saw a clip of her in the news brief. And here's what Francesca Albanese said on March 24th. She said, "I lost count of how many renowned journalists interviewed me on the alleged mistreatment of and sexual abuse against Palestinian women by Israeli forces and never published an article on this." So that's the context in which we have to look at this Amit Susanna story. I don't think we can be engaged in a debate about did this happen, didn't it happen. Even if it did happen, as I noted, it doesn't provide any corroboration whatsoever for the claims about October 7th. It doesn't describe any kind of pattern. And we have to ask why the New York Times would focus a massive, huge story on this while continuing to ignore, along with the rest of the mainstream media, the testimonies and evidence of sexual abuse and humiliation and mistreatment of Palestinian women and men by Israeli forces that are coming out continuously.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, the silence speaks volumes there. What can we learn from this? Why, just for a minute, maybe we could just talk about the timing of this, as Israel is, flouting the UN Security Council resolution, of course, for a ceasefire, as it continues to cut off UN aid deliveries to the north of Gaza, as Israel becomes more and more of an isolated pariah state around the world. Why does the New York Times and other outlets like it continue to launder these stories of hoaxes, developed and put out there by grifters?
They're deeply complicit in this. I mean, these stories are being planted, being shaped with the Israeli government. The original Screams Without Words story was largely sourced from the Israeli military. The fact that we see these same stories repeated time after time after time, in publication after publication, and it's this echo chamber that gives them more credibility by repetition, even though there's no evidence there. And I think a major problem of Israel's mass rapes narrative, which is a result of the debunkings that we and others have done, is that there's no victim, and they desperately needed a victim. And so now they've come up with a victim, albeit not from October 7th. This woman, Amit Susanna, doesn't claim that this incident of this vaguely described assault occurred on October 7th. She's saying it happened while she was in captivity. And so this is someone you can now present and try to silence the critics with, to say, you see, finally, there is a victim. And if you don't believe this, you don't believe women. But it's important to recognize that this isn't some organic thing of this woman deciding to come out and speak and break her silence. This is a big story which the New York Times and clearly the Israeli propaganda apparatus that has been promoting it invested a lot of time and effort into, and that's the context you have to see it in. If this were a woman coming forward, someone, for example, like Tara Reid, who accused President Joe Biden of sexually assaulting her in the many years ago, but during the last campaign, she came out and said, "This happened to me," and she had contemporary witnesses from the time who said, yeah, she told us about this at the time. And again, Zay Squirrel went back and looked at how the New York Times reported on Tara Reid as a woman coming out with very little support and saying, this happened to me, a powerful man did this to me. And the New York Times was completely dismissive and actually went out and just did character assassination against Tara Reid. So again, it's not about whether I sitting here can say what this person is saying is true or not true, but I can look at how the propaganda apparatus treats a person who is going against someone they support, for example, Joe Biden, or serving a power they support. For example, in this case, the testimony of Amit Susanna is serving Israel's genocidal anti-Palestinian narrative, and therefore they treat her as if there's no way she could be telling other than the truth. And that's what we have to be attentive to, how these stories are presented.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Ali. It's really important work uncovering these lies and fabrications and holding the New York Times to account.
An impossible task.
Yeah.
Holding them to account is an impossible task. And I think that's important. You know, I'll just say this about it, because the people still have the idea that the New York Times is somehow doing its job badly when it tells these sorts of lies. But this is exactly its job is to tell these lies. And, you know, we go back to this because it's so crucial. The New York Times promoted the lies about weapons of mass destruction and helped lay the groundwork for the U.S. aggression against Iraq, causing untold damage, untold death, untold disruption to millions of lives. And then later, after the deed was done, they came out with a mea culpa and said, oh, you know, maybe we should have been a bit more skeptical. I won't be surprised if the New York Times does do that in the future with this when it's too late, when the job is already done. And the purpose of those mea culpas is never to actually say we learned the lesson and now we'll stop lying for the government and stop lying for Israel. The purpose is to restore their image in the eyes of the public so they can then come out and do it again. They can tell more lies for the powerful again. This is who they are and this is their job.
That's right. And they'll keep collecting, you know, Polk Awards and Pulitzers for this kind of...
Jeffrey Gettleman,
exactly.
The author of that fraudulent mass rape story of December 28, Pulitzer Prize winner. I wonder if he'll be nominated and maybe win one for this bunch of lies. Let's see.
Would not be surprised. Well, thank you again, Ali. And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada's live stream. Let's bring John on. Hello, John.
Hi, guys. That story is incredible. The New York Times treating a story like a wiki, where they just insert an update in an already published story, is just it's scandalous.
Yeah, I mean, our colleague Michael Brown was talking yesterday about how he couldn't remember if like that, you know, in any other story it would be a correction and then there might be a retraction, but to categorize it as an update and insert it into the text
I can't stress this enough, as if the doubts about this story had not already been exposed prior to its original publication.
Right.
It's so misleading. It's so duplicitous. And
in their own newsroom too, right, Ali? Inside their own newsroom, there's disagreements about this. So even inserting that update is... It's just a scandalous story, and to use that story to justify the brutality that we're seeing in Gaza is enraging.
I mean, that's it. It's a manufacturing of consent for this genocide 6 months in. So, John, you're going to bring us some of the latest news and videos from specifically the battle that has been raging around the Al-Shifa medical complex in Gaza City, what we talked about at the beginning in the news report. And you're also going to detail the remarkable story of a West Bank resistance fighter who held off the Israeli military in the hills around Ramallah. Tamara reported extensively on that. What you got for us?
Yeah, so the significance, of course, of this battle we've seen in Shifa Hospital is that the Palestinians have resisted around the hospital and fought valiantly against this Israeli invasion of the hospital. One of three hospitals, as you said, Nora, in your introduction, that is being raided simultaneously. The Israelis are using these hospitals as propaganda features of their war as well. And they're focusing, as we've said from November, because following this war, hour by hour, it was very clear immediately in the early days of the ground invasion, as we reported on the live stream, that it appeared right away like their operation was destined for the hospital and no other place, that was the goal of the operation, was to attack the hospitals. In November, the justification for the Shifa raid was, of course, that there was a command and control center, that they made this fictitious underground secret lair that Hamas is using. Interestingly, in this raid of Shifa Hospital, there isn't any claims about that, although the previous justification would seem to suggest that the Palestinians would use this tunnel apparatus in the hospital. But this time, now 6 months on, they don't need to lie in detail anymore. They can just lie superficially, and it works. The Israeli, as Nora reported in her introduction, there's brutality all throughout this raid on Shifa Hospital, as is obvious if you raid a hospital full of patients, injured people, and their families looking after them. That's brutal crimes. The Israeli army says that they haven't hurt one single person who's not a terrorist at Shifa Hospital. The lies are just, they're not even trying anymore on these lies. And so I want to report today on the resistance around the hospital, because the focus of the Palestinian resistance in the north has been to fight back against this hospital attack. The hospitals put the resistance in an impossible position.
Welcome back. And that was the electronic intifada from yesterday. And this is the Pan-African Journal. That's going to conclude our program for today. And if you'd like to have access to our program for today, Thursday, March 28, 2024, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network, and that is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll be closing out with the music of Billie Holiday from the album entitled Lady in Satin from 1958. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Toward you, I'm a fool toward you. To want a love that can't be true, a love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you, such a fool to hold you. To seek a kiss, not mine alone. To share a kiss the devil has known. Again, I said I'd leave you.
Today, the subject here is the role of the black woman in America. And there is a small panel to discuss the topic consisting of Peachy Brooks, who is a housewife, a mother of five, born in Virginia, but living in New York for the past 13 years. She lives in Brownsville in Brooklyn, and she's been on welfare for the past 2 years. Also, there is Verda Smart Grosvenor, who is also a mother. She's attended Temple University and the Sorbonne. Born in South Carolina, she's lived in Philadelphia, New York, and Paris. And there is Florence Kennedy, an attorney, who was a delegate to the National Conference on Black Power last year. She is now the director of Media Workshop and a member of the steering committee of the Freedom and Peace Party. And Mrs. Eleanor Norton, who attended Antioch and Yale University. For the past 2.5 years, she's been an assistant legal director at the American Civil Liberties Union National Office in New York City. I think it might be helpful if we could deal initially with a kind of definition of the American Negro or black woman. I would like, if we could for a minute, to deal with those kinds of myths that have to do with the definition we work with, but are perhaps not as true as they should be. Can anyone talk about that?
Well, firstly, Ed Cumberbatch, you make us sound so fascinating, I can hardly wait to hear what we're going to say. But I think that anytime we talk about the black woman, you know, we're stepping into a big trap because we don't know if we're talking about Fannie Lou Hamer or Ruby Dee or whatever. So I suppose we must concede that we're talking at a very high level of abstraction and that, you know, we will come down from that high level from time to time as we talk about specifics. Now, of course, there are lots of myths, and some of them we are caught up by ourselves. Of course, we like the one, some of us, that says that the role of the black woman is very different now, that the men have the starring role, and that we are to be sorry for anything we ever did to lead the way to anywhere. And I think that this is a very big scene among some of the very African-oriented black people here in New York. And I think that it's quite fascinating, and I love seeing the girls being nice and quiet and hardly ever interrupting or anything. You know, at my age, I just babble on and on, and these cool little girls sit there in their afros, you know, and they just don't say anything, and the men say, we are it, and you'll have as many babies as we want you to, and you're not going to have any birth control or abortions. And it's quite fascinating because I come from the old line, you know, where the whole idea was that women were going to, you know, take over and have freedom, and that we were an oppressed group. So women my age, that is over 50, are very big on the freedom for women kick, while younger black women and many of the most political ones are sort of taking the let's let the men go ahead now attitude. So I like to hear the younger ones tell how they like that new role. How about you, Eleanor?
You know, I do think it catches us in a paradox because it would be somewhat ironic when, you know, sort of black people as a whole are beginning to express themselves if the women sort of phase themselves out. And I think it's a kind of real identity crisis for black women. Everyone knows it's one for black men, but as black women search for a kind of new role in what for many of them is a revolutionary period, I think that there is the dilemma created by whether or not to conform with the old cliche or the new cliche, the superactive woman or the underactive woman, and I feel that probably for a period of time there will be a reaction against the old stereotype. Now, I'm not even sure the old stereotype really existed. I'm saying there may be a feeling on the part of young black women that they have to at least act as if a stereotype did exist once, take it as a given, and react against it by becoming kind of super feminine women who don't exist. I think that I think what there is going against that is that perhaps will be a counterbalancing force for black women in this regard is that they are also becoming very political. And if you're going to be very political, you're going to have to have ideas. And if you have ideas, you're going to have to express them at some point. And it may be this new role too brings black women into some sort of reconciliation with themselves.
Is there a problem of identifying with sex versus race at all?
With oneself as a black person versus oneself as a woman.
Exactly.
I think there is in this sense. You belong to two different kinds of groups that have two different kinds of problems. Both groups think they're in motion at this time. Black women think they're in motion. You have the whole thing going on of white women, for example, reacting against the role they played in the 50s, which is a rather absurd one from my point of view. It sort of went into a security thing. So you have sort of active kind of feminism coming back into vogue again. And they clearly have the black thing raising its head. And if one happens to be both black and a woman, one has to come to grips with these two things and decide how one's going to react. One may decide to react to neither, or one may find one of these things pulling at oneself harder than the other.
Werner?
Well, I just want to say that I don't understand what you mean by the role. I think that black women have traditionally always come out of a very natural kind of thing, and they haven't been playing any kind of roles, and they've just done what they've had to do to take care of business. You know, I think this Monahan report has psyched everybody out, and everybody's trying to figure out, you know, from the Monahan report, like when you say that the castration of the man or their role, the women are keeping quiet now. I'm not interested in all that, because I think that the Monahan report is just another one of those things that this lace curtain or shanty Irishman. I can't let him define for our people what we are about. Because in the Depression, when white folks were jumping out of windows, black women were raising 10, 15 children, doing the best they can out of a very natural kind of thing. And Monahan, I don't know where he was at, you know, but now all of a sudden in 1967 it came out, we're going to let this man say that black women are the cause of black men being castrated. It's not true. It's just like with the educational thing. They have the children believing that there's something wrong with the children, why they're not learning. It is not. It is white folks' fault that children aren't learning. It's white folks' fault that the black men were castrated. It's white folks' fault that we are in this dilemma. Dilemma?
Well, the moment, though, allows for a luxury of dealing with the role of the black women in America, which is really not, we're not talking about the immediate situation, we're talking about a future,
right.
which may not have existed before, and I think you're talking about that.
But
to some extent.
I mean, how can you say it didn't exist before? Black women, I mean, they've always done what they've had to. They've existed since black people were brought here.
Has this been a successful existence?
Well, now look at you. Your mama brought you here.
Yeah.
I mean, how can you say, was it successful? I think that on the other hand, we ought to give a whole lot of laurels to black women. It's not, white women's role were not just ridiculous in the 1950s. They've always played a ridiculous role. Black women have been very, you know, all the things that they make negative about or stereotypes about black women are really strengths. Like, they've been very strong.
Well, what are you talking about precisely?
Well, I'm talking about that when you some stereotypes that black women are too strong. You see.
Is that a stereotype?
Oh, yes. Well,
don't you think that men entertain it, though, as well, and black men as well?
Entertain
the notion, this myth. Because, you know, we can't continue to be as oppressed as we are and talk as if there's so many laurels due us. Now, regardless of whose fault it is, the fact remains that many, many black people can't get up off the ground, and what everybody ought to do, in my book, is to die fighting. And to the extent black women kept black men from fighting, as far as I'm concerned, you know, they played a role, and I call it a role, because regardless of whether it's an artificial posture, it is a role. And as far as Monahan and his little hustle, this is a favorite hustle for white people to write about black people and try to rationalize the system of oppression.
Yeah, I wish I
saw
that.
And to speak for the oppressor.
Right.
So, I mean, it's going to get a lot worse because all the colleges are doing.
That's right.
But a girl like Peachy, who rears five kids and sits up here with her little slim waistline, obviously has been, you know, taking care of business.
Yes.
But we have permitted our people to be oppressed. So to that extent, everybody that's oppressed is to blame, because you can't blame an exploiter. You've got to blame the person that consents to the oppression. I think many a black woman has held her man back from taking a gun, blowing somebody's brains out, whose brains, if they had any, needed blowing out.
Peachy Brooks, do you see yourself as an oppressed woman, or as an oppressed black person, or as an oppressed black woman?
Well, I see myself as an oppressed black woman. I have my five children to raise. I try to do that to the best of my knowledge, the best way I know how. They go to practically an all-white school. All the teachers, that is, are practically all-white. All my children have all-white teachers.
But don't you think that in your circumstances, had somebody before you taken care of business in an appropriate way, we would have an equitable share of a gross national product, which I think now is well over $850 billion. Now, you don't surely feel that it's equitable for people who are millionaires not to pay one cent of taxes and then complain about people who are on welfare who just can barely make out and, you know, feed their families properly. Now, we hear that the people on welfare are somehow to blame for the circumstances, for example, the situation in the cities, as they like to talk about, the dilemma of how to keep black people from, you know, taking down the cities, you see. And we somehow are always put in the position of being the wrongdoers. They make it sound like it's such a kick to be on welfare.
Yeah.
And half the time, you're not even getting what you're entitled
to. You're right about that.
And in the meantime, the few people who do pay taxes, and almost all of them are poor people, do not get any kind of deduction that's comparable to the 27.5% oil depletion allowance.
Mm-hmm.
So what really happens is that working black people are supporting industry, you see, and then the people who aren't permitted to work because the jobs are not made available to them are then put in the position of being wrongdoers somehow and being lucky because they don't have to work,
mm-hmm.
you see. And I really think that the unionization and organization of welfare, women, by women usually, is a very exciting thing. When we were in Boston, you know, in Roxbury, the organization of Mothers for Adequate Welfare that was called MA was a very thrilling sight because it turned out that they were not getting the pittances that they were supposed to get, such as, you know, a little bit of money when a kid is going to graduate or a little bit of money at Christmas time and this
That's
sort of
true.
Thing.
All right. What is there about American black women that the country really doesn't know anything about? This was my original question, really. What are the myths that exist that make an understanding, a comprehension so difficult?
Well,
at this time when there is such change in the society.
Well, first place, I think I agree with Eileen Norton that there is not such change. I think she implied that when she said we like to think of ourselves as in motion. I think there is very, very little change, and which change there is, I believe, is in retrograde, which means that we're losing ground a little bit. Because, you see, the black people are at a lower level, and they are required to stay at that level. And anytime anybody talks about equality, when I'm 10 or 15 or 20 levels below somebody else, it just means that I will be maintained at that level, and whatever slippage I've experienced is not going to be allowed to continue. Now, as to your question about what America doesn't understand about black people, you see, a system of oppression, as I see it, and this is what I think we're talking about, and it applies both to women and to black people, men and women, requires the consent of the oppressed. And this is something that both oppressors and oppressed people tend to overlook. So the reason why you have a lot of myths and roles, and I can see why Verda objects to that, because it is a part of the mythology to draw roles that aren't really honest, is that you can't afford to see a person as an equal or a human being even if you're going to continue to oppress them.
Mm-hmm.
So you build myths about your oppressors, and you build myths about the people you oppress. And you make the women seem to be oversexed because they have children. But at the same time, you're driving the men out of the home, because if the men are in the home unable to get jobs, the women can't get welfare. So you got a hustler like Moynihan that comes in and pretends to have a whole lot of insight, when in fact all he's doing is blaming black people for what white people did from the moment they came over as slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing that the white people did was to make studs out of the black people, the black men, separate the women from the men, let the white men have them at will. Then you wonder why it is that it seems that some girls don't mind having children out of wedlock. They were programmed to do that historically. And the welfare system perpetuates this attitude and process, because many times if a man cannot get a proper job, he must leave his family.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing that white people can't possibly conceive of is what Negro family life is like, quite apart from Moynihan, you know, who's really irrelevant, in the sense that when one belongs to an oppressed group, and one is in, let us say, the family unit, one is, regardless of one's role, one is forced into a kind of partnership with his partner that family life with unoppressed people may not experience. That is to say, when one is black, when one's in a family, one faces straight on the question of survival. When one is white in a family, family life may mean something else. The woman may have a kind of a comfortable stereotyped role. stereotypes through the ages of Western civilization. The man has another stereotyped role. We all know what these roles are. The moment we take that same unit and we put it in the and we talk about it in terms of oppressed people, we're talking about a different kind of unit altogether. I think that white people, when they think about Negro families, probably don't think about family life at all, and they certainly don't conceive of a situation where woman and man thrown in an extraordinary conflict for survival have to redefine family life, redefine the family organization, work together in a strange way relative to
be fundamentally different about this family that you're referring to.
Well, I think that
which will call upon either a great strength on the part of the woman involved. Verda, do you want to talk about this at all? Or?
Well, in my neighborhood, what's difficult about being a black mother is being black. Being a mother, that's very difficult.
It is.
Considering the two children that I got. But
they were born at 90.
Yes. Yeah, they're sort of old women, you know, having one old woman in the second grade and one old lady in the kindergarten who's on probation, Head Start dropout.
Mm-hmm.
But I have problems like that. And one of the other problems I noticed is the principal called me and said that I should come to the school because my daughter, my kindergarten daughter, was not performing according to Hoyle or somebody like that. So I went up, and one of the things I realized, he had threatened her. He said, if you're not good, I will tell your mother. Now, I remember when I was in school, if the principal said that and he said he was going to call your mother and you were black, when my mother got to school, the first thing she said to the principal was, you just do what you want to do with her.
My mother and father were very different.
No, well, you
I'll
see,
tell you about it.
Yeah,
later.
Well, this is, but I mean, this is really, my mother, this is sort of, I think, traditionally black. They said, well, I've tried to do what I can do
with
her.
Yeah, it's all yours.
Right, it's all yours. Whatever y'all want to do, y'all just do it. I try to teach you. What if y'all have to do this or blah, 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 you go ahead and do it. So I went to school, and he told me what had happened, and I said, oh, really? Is that what happened? I said, gee. He said, well, your attitude isn't right.
But don't you think when we talk publicly, we sometimes romanticize the family unit? Isn't it a fact that because of economic circumstances, and for excellent reasons, a lot of black women have walked away from their kids and have sent their kids back home and have other people caring for their children? I doubt if we could name 10 mothers without thinking of at least one or two who have had to possibly send their kids home. Well, I certainly, maybe it's because I'm in law practice, know of any number of women who have their kids either with grandparents or who are living alone and who have the kids living with aunts and uncles. And so I think it's perfectly possible to draw a picture of a family unit where there's all this love and understanding, but really ignoring the fact that there are a lot of people, Eleanor, I'm sure you know a lot of them, who are really unfortunately having to walk away from their kids. And not that I don't understand why. I don't know how as many mothers as do stay with them, because I find that children are among the more horrendous creatures of the world. But I really admire these girls that stay with these kids. But there are just an awful lot of children being reared by people other than their parents, I think. And I think the economic situation has a lot to do with it. I mean, an older woman can't get a job, so she can stay home and take care of the children. And if she doesn't live in the metropolitan area where so many women are, well, then they often send them away.
Isn't that percentage less than it is for white people?
No, I think not. No,
oh,
I think so.
I think white people give up their children much quicker, and it may only be economics than black women, white women, to me. I mean,
I think one of the reasons a lot of white women who are separated or divorced or weren't ever married don't give up their children is, in the first place, they tend to adopt children if they're not in a position to keep them. Now, in that sense, you're absolutely right. I think I think the kids that are called Negro in the adoption agencies are usually the children, are many times are the children of white people, white women with black men. And in those cases, I think it's a racist concept that they become black just because one of the parents is black. So they talk about Negro foundlings, and I do think that black women don't give up their babies at birth. And certainly if you count in that that group of kids, then you'd have a lot of white women giving up their children. But they give them up at birth. Whereas black women, I think, probably more frequently, just judging from my limited notice of it, would seem to keep their children theoretically, but when at the age of 3 or 5 or 8 they can't get a job, don't find welfare satisfactory, or for some reason or another can't get on welfare or feel they can manage if they can just get the kid to someone that will keep them, then I think they tend to deposit them in various places. But I think, Verda, you're absolutely right that if you take into account the number of white mothers who abandon their children at birth, then of course I think you have a much, much larger number.
There's been a lot of discussion recently of the revolution within American society of the female. She's holding jobs she never held before, and she's become...
Name one.
may I? she's become sought after by political candidates as a very significant block vote, but very fundamentally connected with this assumed revolution is the pill. And I'm wondering if there is any meaning concerning this invention that has to do with black women that just hasn't been talked about. Does it apply the same, in other words, as a convenience for black women as opposed to white women? Eleanor?
Well, you know, I think the pill is seen in society at large as a liberating factor for women. It is liberated women from the age-old biological dependency that comes from getting pregnant when you don't want to get pregnant. I think it's unfortunate that the pill has not, as yet, in my opinion at least, had the effect in the black community that I think it ultimately, that it's had in the white community and that it ultimately will have. I don't understand. One thing I really don't understand is the notion that black women somehow, that it's revolutionary for black women to continue to have as many children as their health will allow them to bear, which while other women are going in exactly the opposite direction. I think the pill can transform life in any country for any group of people, but what it can do for women who belong to an oppressed group, tied and bound economically, for whom childbirth with all its joys has also had its sorrows in greater proportion than it has had for white women, is, I think, potentially astounding. The notion of planned births for black women, it seems to me, is far more revolutionary concept than it is for white women. White women have been, one way or the other, controlling their birthing, sometimes imperfectly, before the pill. Black women, for black women, it was often a case of getting toward middle class status before one even incorporated that notion. The pill, however, is increasingly being manufactured cheaper and cheaper, which means that you finally have the possibility, in this country at least, that this liberating little pharmaceutical miracle may make it possible for black women to do their thing their own way. Now, I don't think that has anything to do with whether or not one wants to bear 15 children or one wants to bear no children. The important thing, it seems to me, is that decision-making be introduced for childbearing in the black community. Not that black children be no longer produced, but that somehow a black woman not be a biological slave to her uterus. I don't want to eliminate her uterus, but I do want her to be able to make the decision along with whatever mate she is dealing with about that
terribly crucial factor of when she's going to have children and how many children she's going to have. And once she's able to make that decision, it seems to me, a thousand other kinds of decisions are going to be influenced by.
Peachy, do many women you know in Brownsville use the pill?
Yes, practically all the women I know use the pill. I use it myself. I think it's a lifesaver. Most of the women, they don't use it because they're afraid to use it. They hear so many different things about it. But me, I've been taking it for about a year and a half now. So far, it hasn't done anything to me. Anything bad, that is. I live by it. I never forget to take it.
How important has it been to you?
Oh, it's very important to me.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very important militant attitude among black militants that the pill is a trick, really, and it's an aspect of genocide, that if we do not have children, we will be less than we are now in time to come. And that if we send our sons to the war in Vietnam, we'll be less than we are now.
Those are two different. That's genocide, though.
There are many. I guess.
I don't equate the two at all. I think Berta wanted to say something.
Yes.
I wanted to say a lot. I wanted to say, although I, on one hand, I understand what you mean by the pill as a lifesaver. But I really don't think at this time. I figure this is my own personal theory. I figure that if we have come through 350 or 400 years of misery, there's no reason at this point for us now to orientate our people. They're going to have a nice, happy life by laying down and you won't have babies and enjoying your uterus. If we've gone through that, we might as well continue till the struggle.
We've been miserable for 300 years. We just won't be miserable for another 100.
Until something is won. That's right. Because, I mean, why should we orientate? I do not think that we should orientate black people to this two-child, one girl, one boy type of Americana family. Bobby Kennedy does
How
not
many children
have
do you have, Berta?
I only have two.
Okay.
I only been
talk
pregnant
to
twice.
Five.
Yeah.
You know, see.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand what you mean. I know that, you know, it ain't.
Well, are you against the pill, or are you against large
family? No, I'm against
family.
Orientating our people toward it. It's
Why
a pleasant
not?
Thing. Because if they are going to Vietnam, if they are being lynched, if they are being shot in the streets, and we are talking about the future of our people, we are not going to have very many people left. You know, what I'm against is, it seems to me that the orientation is, if you have enough money, you therefore have the license to have more children. Well, who has enough money?
Well, you
only
see,
people who have these money and these certain kinds of jobs. How do you get those jobs? From various means. Also, we are in the richest country in the world.
Right.
We should be, everybody should be born with the a place to live and enough to eat. There should be no reason why if you have five children, you can't feed them in this rich country. If one man has 50, it's no reason for one man to have $10 million and some people be starving.
But
and then
Berta,
say that them people don't have right to have children. We should have as many children if we want a nation.
Nobody's talking about
children.
The right to have children. We're talking
as
about
as a mother of two children,
well,
darling.
Let us
I must say you've been very lucky, or else. Very abstinent. But let me simply say this, dear, that if you're going to get that money and change the system, you might just have to do some running and hiding, you understand? And it's a little hard to run and hide, you know, and fight for that share of the pie. And if you can't end the corruption, get in on it, you know. If you got four or five kids hanging around.
Well, we have never had that kind of thing.
All right,
now, so I said, let's just see how it works like that. We've had these 350 years of other kind of things.
You've
let's
got
see how
two
it is.
Kids, and I still
but
say.
But it doesn't have to be about me.
Well,
I say, let's not orientate our people to Americana.
Your passion is inconsistent with your circumstances.
Your passion
for people having a whole passel of children.
I didn't say a whole passel.
That's not right now. So what I'm suggesting, dear,
is that if we are truly revolutionary, it seems to me that some of us at least might want to travel light. And it may be that if women are going to have to go to jail, because I tell you one thing about oppression, you might be all right as long as you stay near the middle of the area. Mm-hmm. But when you start testing the fence, honey, whether you're black, white, woman, or man, you become instantly niggerized, you see. And one of the reasons why black women may find that some of their revolution won't even have to take place is because the youth is learning this, and with an alliance between black people and youth, the women may be able to be third in the line in the revolution if there should be one. But I promise you that I sometimes suspect that the CIA is programming black nationalists to talk like this, because if I had a group that was about to withdraw consent to oppression, I would like nothing better than that they should be bogged down in a big family setup with little kids to run back home to, you know, and keep, you know, getting sitters for. And I promise you that in India, which is a poverty-stricken, distraught land in many respects, this whole idea of proving your manhood by producing children prevails. Now, in a country which is so committed to fascism and racism that there's no likelihood that you're ever going to get that fair share of the pie that you're talking
about.
About
this, you're talking about this country?
What other? What other, baby? Which is the most fascistic, genocidal. All right, then. So in such a country, it would seem to me that it might be well for at least those people who have a political awareness to consider foregoing this luxury that you talk about, and I don't see that Peachy, who has had that great experience, would agree with you. I gather that she might love each one of her five children and yet be glad that the number isn't seven.
That's right.
And from the way I've seen you with Chandra and the little queen, I think there are times when you're very delighted that you have two instead of three.
Oh, yeah.
You know, perhaps to arrange for when you want to go someplace.
But what I really said was I just don't think that we ought to orientate in terms of this whole pillar.
Are you suggesting that just because white people have finally made this available to us, you know, this reminds me of the guy on the subway that has a roach or bed bug on his shoulder and some white man knocks it off and he says, mm-hmm. You put that back up there. You white people don't let us have anything.
No, Flo, you may be able to run it down much more articulately than I am. I still emotionally do not agree with you about this thing. And also, if you check out in terms of the world, who are the people who are not supposed to have children? I'm just saying that there's something wrong with the whole...
What is this about not supposed... Let's stop for a minute on that, Berta. The people who have the fewest children in our society are white people and rich people. It, you know, the people who have the most children are black people and poor people.
Meaning
that we already enjoy the luxury of having many children.
But look at what
the rich people
that from you? Who have two children enjoy. Look at the millions of things that they enjoy. I'm trying to say that
I'm completely confused.
I'm not confused.
Well, Verda, what is your point?
My point is that I have one point. Just like I said before, we should not orientate. I just feel we should not orientate our people to a two.
Are you talking about your people or about
your sex? I'm talking about black people.
What about women?
Black families.
Let me ask you this, please. What about women and the pill, and black women and the pill? Isn't it an advantage to them or not?
Well, again, sure, it's an advantage.
Why?
I agree with everything Eleanor said.
Berta is thinking about, and I share with her the abhorrence of this sort of, you know, two family, two children, two car, you know,
that's
white
you
family.
You
know, their
children.
Lives are programmed, you know, terribly. But I believe if you think about it for a moment, you know, just as Ed tried to isolate it. Not in terms of whether or not black leaders, let us say, are orienting us as a political matter to reduce our family size. Think about it, not in those terms, but in strictly human terms, whether or not one can have any humanity and not consider the question of whether or not a particular woman wishes to bear a child. Now, some women will decide as a revolutionary act that they're going to bear 10 black soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Let them have the freedom to decide that. They say, I want to do it because I want to make up all that the whitey is going to kill. fine. I'm for that chick making that decision. Some other chick is going to decide this. I have had three here. There is no man to take care of these three. I love these three. Thank God for these three, and I don't want no more three. I want her to be able to make her decision not to have three more black soldiers. That's the same way that this other chick has made the decision to have 10 more. And we're now that's 13. Just talking about the individual decision that should be left, it seems to me, in the final analysis, to that black woman who, after all, is giving her body in this way. It's nobody else's body but hers.
I agree 100% with Eleanor. The pill does, well, this is the way I feel about it. If I want to have another baby, I would stop taking the pill. If I don't want to have any more, I continue to take the pill. This is the advantage.
There hasn't been, although I guess somebody would disagree with me, a traditional anti-feminism in America. That is, it has not been as deep-rooted as it has been in most of the European countries, for instance. And success of women in terms of getting the vote and other legal rights, which perhaps are more important as they may pertain to property and so forth, has been more or less more liberal in the United States than in any other area.
Oh, Ed Cumberbatch, you sound so square. You know you're not that square. You know perfectly well that the whole attitude of the establishment is to make us feel lucky. Mm-hmm. You can buy all those overpriced cosmetics. You can buy that 4 cents worth of nail polish and pay $1.22 for it. You lucky little thing. You look at you in the Life magazine, $52,000 worth of advertising that you are paying for out of your welfare budget if you happen to buy a lipstick that's advertised in Life magazine. Believe me, I know that you can, if you think about it, realize that this idea that the American woman is not so terribly oppressed just simply will not hold water.
But you know, but it may
be
the relative to
because
you.
We're forced into the role of a consumer position to support an establishment that is oppressing women, men, and the whole country.
That's
practically
true. That's true.
You see, and it's artificial. We are supporting an unfavorable balance of trade. We're being economically raped consistently. Mm. Then we get up and say thank you, mister, and pay the rapist. You know, and believe me, the consumer position of women is the sickest and saddest one, and in that sense, all women, but naturally the poor black woman, is most consistently oppressed, you see. And politically, it is a joke. 51% of the American adult population is women, and you look in the Senate and the House, and you find that possibly there are four or five women who did not get there through the death of their husband. I guess if a woman wants to go to Congress, first she puts her husband there and then she poisons him. I mean, that's her best bet because the chance of getting there as a woman is practically nil, you see. Women can usually get to any high position through the bedroom, you know. T. Grace Atkinson of Now, who is not black but who is quite clever in my opinion, has a quote that she favors, which says, "The American dream is a chicken in every pot, a whore in every home." And this is one reason I think the black women, as Verna points out, does have an advantage over the white women. Because at least since black men are so broken, poor, and pitiful in many cases, and since they can probably get a better job than he can, they don't have that demeaning position of being a prostitute all the time, you see. So that to the extent that black women do have a freedom from prostitution, I think they have a definite advantage. I think the reason you have so many sherry drinkers in Connecticut and alcoholics on Park Avenue is because of this role of being with a man you really don't like very much and having to stay with him because he's got you, you know, in a clean, dry place, plenty of clothes, and, you know, and just a couple of kids and no real use and, you know, a role that is fairly well defined.
Is the black woman, though, to simply wrench herself from a consumer society, from...
Well, I think...
What are the differences there?
I think the dollar is a tool that none of the women have begun to use at all. Regardless of revolt, regardless of rebellion, regardless of politics,
The dollar is the tool with which women, black and white, but most especially black since they have so few, dig their rut, which ultimately becomes their grave. You see, it's their possible weapon for liberation as well as is the tool for their being in the rut they're in. Because if they use the dollar to rebel against the establishment, they could bring some changes about that would not require them to go to jail and would not permit the establishment, political and economic, to put them in a trick bag, which is where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I think the dollar is one of the chief keys to woman power, the woman being empowered to resist oppression. But mm-hmm. first she has to recognize she is oppressed, then she has to look around for the three tools that every person have who decides to become empowered. One is their body, the second one is the vote, and the third one is the dollar, in reverse order.
I'm afraid, you know, it's not all that simple to me. I do think that black women are freer to go in a new direction. That belonging to an oppressed black group, which is rethinking its whole thing, is bound to encourage black women to rethink their whole thing. White women may not necessarily have the impetus to rethink their whole situation. But if one is in the least bit thoughtful, and one is a black woman, because of the fantastic changes that are called for and that are being called for, she is bound to have to think very seriously about reorienting her situation. I know for myself, I'm still working out the dilemma I feel as a woman committed to a professional life and as a woman committed to her husband and to having a family at some point. I think I get the commitment to a professional life in part from being a Negro, from being a woman in a race of women who were used to working and used to playing that kind of role. When I went to school with white girls in college, they tended not to think of themselves as performing some sort of professional function in their lives because their mothers had not done so. My mother had, and I thought that way. On the other hand, my generation of women, of black women, has begun to think very seriously about her relationship to the black man, and she's very intrigued by the black man and with the notion of making him happy and with seeing, you know, what's happening to him and seeing him in his thing. And so I've got to think about that, too. 20 years ago, as a young black woman, I may not have been as sensitive to that other thing, that male thing. I might have been more perhaps as sensitive to the professional thing, so that, you know, I'm sort of working out four or five different things that are sort of highlighted by the period in which I live, and I think that's true for black women in general, even though they'll work this thing out differently. I might say, for example, that some black women are going to end up working the thing out so that they break with the tradition of black women working, because they're going to be married to increasingly economically viable men. They're going to assume a role of staying home with their children, being able to do so. It's a role I don't particularly want, but I bet you're going to find more and more black women playing that kind of traditional role. So I think, you know, some surprising things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Verda, would you like to be a mother or a worker?
Well, I guess...
What might be your best, your most wishful ambition?
I guess most of all, I would like to be a mother because for this space age that we live in, you know, with our revolution and the whole revolution in the world, this is a very exciting time. And perhaps I've been into a lot of things. And I think the most rewarding is probably being a mother. If I can be that really fully. You know, people don't give mothers enough credit. It's a very difficult job. It takes practically a college degree to figure out with a certain amount of money how to shop for your family, give them the pop, you know, you're responsible for these people growing, what they think, what they do. These are going to be, you know, youth of tomorrow or youth very soon in 5-10 years. And so to be a mother is a very responsible job. It is a profession, I think. And I think in the space age, that will come up. It will not become that, somebody who goes off to a job and then just a mother who's left with the children. I think that a mother will be a very important person and should be. And I guess most of all, I like to be a mother.
Revolution, all those
you didn't mind that acting role in that off-Broadway
play. No, that was very nice. See, I said a mother with certain vacations. Now, I'm like, if we could have
a trip to Paris,
if we could have a society where mothers, that's what I mean, mothers, those are French benefits.
Well, Peachy, more than anything, you have been a mother, I assume.
Well, no. No. Up until 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I was a working mother.
Mm-hmm.
But
are you working now?
No.
What would you like to do from now on in, and why will it be difficult as a mother?
Well, from now on in until my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old gets older, I'd rather be a mother to them. Because with my other 3 children, my mother raised them. Up until a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a mother to them. My mother was. So I'd really like to be a mother too. A full-time mother. To raise my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old. Then maybe later on, I would like to go back to work. Because sometimes it gets quite boring being a mother. Even with 5 children.
In the final seconds of this show, Ed, I just want to point out that women do have to keep their eye on both roles of the motherhood and the worker, because in the case of Mrs. Martin Luther King, whom the Freedom and Peace Party just nominated for a vice presidency, I think that you always got to watch in a violent society like ours, where a man might take a leadership, or even if he doesn't take a leadership, that you may become the breadwinner and the parent for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I do hope, incidentally, to put in a little plug, that the black women will take seriously the role of Mrs. Martin Luther King as a vice presidential candidate, and that they will use this as a stick to make a little broom, you know, to do a little sweeping, so that possibly if they do their thing right from now to November, then conceivably the major parties will have either to put a woman, or most especially a black woman, on the ticket, or a black man on the ticket, to offset the effect of this movement.
Welcome back. And that was a panel discussion held over WBAI in New York in 1968, discussing the role of African-American women. And, of course, this is Women's International Women's History Month. And here at the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast, we have been paying tribute to the legacy of the struggle of women throughout the African world. And we'll take a break, and we'll be back with our concluding comments for this program, the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March the 28th, 2024. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and we're going to conclude this day's program. That was the music of Candy Staten, When You Wake Up Tomorrow. And, of course, we're going to close out once again with the music of Aretha Franklin. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. And, of course, we are here on a weekly basis here at the Pan-African Journal. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Public is longing to see you.
Well,
how was it in Rotterdam?
Very, very good.
Yes?
Much better than I expected.
Oh, yes. What did you expect?
I wasn't sure.
It's your first trip outside the USA?
That's right.
And what do you expect on the continent?
I'm not exactly sure, but I'm looking forward to good days.
Well, you're in Soul City now, Amsterdam.
Very good.
That's our Soul City. Well, it started a long time ago for you.
Yeah.
Now you have had 5 or 6 million sellers?
Five. And five singles.
And three albums.
Three albums, but only 1 million seller. The album.
The second one not yet, but...
No.
I think...
We hope.
Who brought you over? It's King Curtis?
No. Just my husband and my agent and my sister and myself.
You were from Detroit?
That's right.
How was your homecoming concert? Tell me something about it.
Extraordinary.
Yes?
There were about 13,000 people there. And it was just too fantastic.
Your record 3 years ago, and by then, I mean, here in Holland, which is quite unique, I think. I mean, someone brought him from America. And, well, you know, gave a real good kick. But 3 years ago, it wasn't that swinging for you, was it?
No. All of this has happened in the last year.
And how, I mean, what was the break, actually? Where?
Atlantic Records, I think. I'll be singing like Jimmy the Ranking with him.
Is that your opening number?
Mm-hmm.
And the showstoppers, the finale?
Oh, I don't know about that, but that's
not
the opener.
Definitely.
Yeah. We changed. We did use something else up in Rotterdam, but we decided to change.
Thank you.
Okay, stay here, stay here. Don't let them see your face, all right? No, because when they're all coming this way, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, listen, they're all standing.
You got to have a show, you know, and then, Mark.
Yo, it's let now hear Ava or Platy. Platy Ava play, okay? Play a bass, Mark. Other Ava play. Play a bass, later. Go.
dames en heren, en nu gaat u allemaal zitten. Allemaal zitten, anders gaat de show niet door. U gaat nu allemaal zitten. Anders, u gaat nu zitten. Oké? Nu gaat u zitten en u staat niet meer op. Ik heb het vriendelijk gevraagd, het kan niet. U gaat nu zitten, anders gaan we niet door. Oké, het is dus aan u. Ladies and gentlemen, here she is again, Miss Aretha Franklin.